there's 2 5 million BTU boilers in this room, and it's completely quiet. That is not normal.
Green energy for the NOAA facility in Juneau. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a second day is set for honoring Senator Ted Stevens.
It's right that Alaska establish a day in his honor, because we know that a giant such as Uncle Ted will not pass this way again.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu/learn. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Governor Sean Parnell today at a bill signing ceremony established the fourth Saturday in July as Ted Stevens Day. Stevens was a giant in Alaska politics, involved in statehood and virtually every political battle waged in the state for nearly 60 years. He was the longest serving Republican in U.S. Senate history, representing Alaska for more than 40 years. But Parnell said it goes without saying that Stevens was a friend of everyone in the legislature, which unanimously passed the bill honoring him.
Regardless of party, the man loved Alaska, loved Alaskans, and it's right that Alaska establish a day in his honor, because we know that a giant such as Uncle Ted will not pass this way again.
After Stevens died in a plane crash last August, Parnell established the late senator's birthday, November 18th, in honor of him. But Stevens' family requested that it be in the summer so Alaskans could celebrate outdoors. Stevens' loved ones were not able to attend the bill signing, but as Stevens often did when negotiations in the U.S. Senate got tough, Parnell wore an incredible Hulk tie to the ceremony. He said it was given to him by Stevens' daughter, Lily. Parnell is currently locked in tough negotiations with the state Senate majority over the capital and operating budgets. Several legislators from both chambers attended the ceremony, though Parnell only recognized members of the House. The House, Senate, and governor are still at odds over how to get to an adjournment of this year's special session. The operating and capital budgets are still remaining, and the coastal management and scholarship bills are also still in the mix. As of now, the Senate has adjourned until Monday morning, but the House still plans a Saturday morning floor session, although there is nothing on the calendar for members to consider. Joining us from Juneau is APRN's Dave Donaldson. Hi, Dave.
Hi there.
What seems to be holding up some sort of resolution to these differences? First of all, the coastal management bill.
The people who are allegedly negotiating these differences between the governor and the coastal residents, if so far, they just haven't said what specific issues are even being talked about, or at least not in great detail, and what they're coming up with conclusions for them. We know some of them because they have come out in earlier meetings, but you know, what it's shown, though, is that there is a dissatisfaction with enough of the most recent proposal that, you know, they just still can't get it together.
The capital projects budget is the other big problem on the table. Is there progress on that one?
The Senate yesterday wrote a letter to the governor offering to drop some of their requirements that were written in the bill, and in exchange for a commitment that their energy bills were going to be protected from vetoes. And, you know, the governor threatened to veto Senate members' capital projects, particularly the energy projects, based on his whether the members supported his oil tax cut. Tax cuts for the oil industry. Well, the offer got an immediate rejection from the House anyway, and it was not followed by any kind of a counteroffer. They just got no. And that does not really indicate a willingness to release some pressure on some of those Senate concerns and got us into this condition in the first place. It looks like the Senate's going to make public a budget over the weekend, maybe tonight, but they aren't going to take any action on it until the House and governor start talking, and that could be sometime, with luck, early next week.
Well, Dave, last week you were saying that the special session could have concluded by midweek, the weekend at the latest. What happened?
You know, the only thing I can tell you with any kind of certainty is that I just don't know what to expect. That's because everything is being secret. Members are making it a point to keep details to themselves. Their options, what they're considering, even who is included in any sort of talks. It's all behind closed doors, and the public just doesn't know what's happening.
All right, Dave. Well, thanks for that update.
My pleasure.
APRN's Dave Donaldson reporting from Juneau. Just in time for Earth Day, the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute in Juneau has gone green. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration facility turned off its two oil-fired boilers last week. It's now warmed entirely with a heat pump system that uses recycled seawater from scientific experiments. From Juneau, KTOO's Casey Kelly takes us on a tour.
The boiler room of a 66,000-square-foot building is not supposed to sound like this.
There's two 5 million BTU boilers in this room, and it's completely quiet. That is not normal.
John Cooper is facilities manager for the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute, TESMARI for short.
We are now using 0 gallons of fuel.
It all starts here, in the building's wet lab. About 400 gallons of seawater per minute are being pumped through the giant holding tanks used by scientists to study species ranging from salmon to starfish. The water circulates through the tanks, then drains into troughs in the floor.
All of that water gets pumped into the heat pump system for us to extract heat from.
The facility's basement holds a spaghetti-like maze of pipes. Two heat pumps cool the seawater, treat it, then heat it up to 120 degrees. In simple terms, a heat pump absorbs heat energy from a vaporizing fluid, in this case the seawater, and releases the heat when it condenses. Cooper likens it to a reverse refrigerator.
When the refrigerator's on, there's always warm air coming out of the back of the refrigerator. And in this case, we're taking that heat that would have come out of the back of the refrigerator, and we're using that heat to heat the building, and the cold that's inside the refrigerator, that is what we're getting rid of.
Jim Rehfeldt of Alaska Energy Engineering designed the system, which was installed by the building's maintenance staff. Rehfeldt says it was like a puzzle that came together perfectly.
They had the seawater, they had in-house staff, they had mechanical systems that could be optimized, and by going through that process and start showing people energy savings, you now have buy-in. People saying, hey, we should be doing this. Let's put resources to it. Let's make it happen.
In addition to the heat pumps, the facility's maintenance staff retrofitted the building to help control airflow. The modifications are expected to save about $130,000 a year in fuel costs. That's factoring in the extra $100 a day in electricity it takes to run the system. So what's it like to work in the building now? Institute Deputy Director Steve Ignell says it's great.
This is fairly transparent to the staff. It's not transparent to our budget, but it's transparent in terms of our indoor environment.
Other NOAA facilities are starting to take notice. Rehfeldt is currently consulting on a similar project for the agency's research center in Kodiak.
And Kodiak has higher energy prices, so it even looks better there than it does here.
The two-year project cost about $500,000. Building officials expect a five-year payback period, sooner if oil prices remain high. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Southeast tribes raise concerns over subsistence.
Very often the voice of our rural people get consumed by the larger numbers of urban centers.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
A spectacular mishap in which a $424 million NASA research satellite was lost in the Pacific has caused the launch of a military satellite from the Kodiak Launch Complex to be delayed for several months. KMXT's Jacob Resnick explains.
The U.S. Air Force had initially announced it would launch a Minotaur 4 rocket in May, but now an Air Force spokesman says the launch won't be until midsummer or early fall. The spokesman asked not to be named. The cause of the delay can be traced to a malfunction of a similar rocket last month. An apparent malfunction of a launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California destroyed NASA's Glory mission, a climate research satellite that had been mounted on a Taurus XL rocket. Space Flight Now reported this week that the Glory mission had failed to separate properly in mid-flight, and the payload was lost in the Pacific Ocean. While of a different design, the Taurus XL shares some of the same components as the Minotaur 4, causing the Air Force to ground the mission as a precaution. The Minotaur 4 is based on the Peacemaker ICBM missile and is the same type of rocket that successfully launched from Kodiak's Narrow Cape last November. The Air Force says the exact nature of the problem that occurred is still unknown, and it's still awaiting the facts before committing to a launch date in Kodiak. The Air Force added that the military satellite is the only mission currently booked for the Kodiak Launch Complex, which is owned by the state-owned Alaska Aerospace Corporation. In Kodiak, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Southeast Alaska's winter troll fishery closed Wednesday night. The Department of Fish and Game expected the king salmon catch would reach the guideline harvest level of 45,000 fish by that time. In slower seasons, the fishery can run through the end of April, but this year wasn't slow. Troll management biologist Patty Scannis announced the April 20th closure shortly after some big landings.
I had a suspicion we might have to close early this year, but I was surprised when I saw what came in over the weekend this past few days. We had a lot of fish.
As the season wrapped up Wednesday, Scannis says catches and effort had been above average during the six-month season.
Our harvest is running about 50% ahead of last year and the five-year average, and it's slightly above the 10-year average. Effort has been up. In most weeks, we have seen a slightly higher number of permits fishing, and now that the season is just about done, it is a fair amount higher than last year and the five-year average.
Scannis says king salmon prices on average were $7.10 a pound during the winter fishery. Douglas Cairns is a world-renowned pilot and has type 1 diabetes. That would have been impossible just over a decade ago due to widespread restrictions against flying with the disease. Today, Cairns holds several aviation records, and on Tuesday, he touched down in Barrow after making a landmark expedition to the North Pole. KBRW's Jake Neer has more.
Cairns took off from Barrow early Tuesday morning and arrived at the geographic North Pole around 5 p.m. Alaska time. He then circled around the pole, passing through 24 time zones in 2 minutes. He then landed on the sea ice at a Russian research station nearby to get ready for his trip back. Cairns returned to Barrow late Tuesday night after completing the fastest ever round-trip flight between Barrow and the North Pole. But this isn't his first accomplishment as an aviator. He holds 5 world speed records, 2 transcontinental records, and landed in all 50 U.S. states plus Washington, D.C. in less than 5.5 days last year. The previous record was 13 days. After his latest feat, I got the opportunity to talk with Cairns in the cockpit of his light twin engine, Beech Baron B-58.
You look behind you here in the cockpit, I've got 2 110-gallon fuel tanks sitting behind us here. In the nose bay, I've got a 37-gallon fuel tank. This is all extra fuel. So I had enough fuel for about 21 hours of flying.
But for Cairns, the preparation doesn't stop at having enough fuel or supplies in his small 40-year-old aircraft. He also needs to pay careful attention to the fuel in his bloodstream at all times. That's because Cairns has type 1 diabetes. He told me about how he discovered he had the disease when he was a 19-year-old pilot in the British Royal Air Force.
I'd been not feeling myself for 6 weeks, and I was fatigued. It was all classic symptoms of type 1 diabetes, fatigued, hungry, I didn't have any energy, and I was incredibly thirsty, and I was losing weight.
After 6 weeks and having lost 26 pounds, he finally decided to go visit the doctor on his base.
And his quote that I use now is, "You are a diabetic and you were a pilot." Very harsh words, and I do hope his bedside manner has changed or improved over the last 22 years. But he was absolutely right, because in 1989, not one single country anywhere in the world would allow anybody with type 1 diabetes to fly, even on a private pilot's license, let alone have a military or commercial flying career.
So Cairns was forced out of the Royal Air Force and changed careers. But he found ways to keep flying legally, with flying clubs and with an instructor at his side at all times. But in 1999, he found out the United States would start allowing diabetics to fly solo on private licenses if they could prove they had reasonable control over their blood sugar levels. That's about the time Cairns started showing off, but he says he has good reason to do so.
The messaging behind this, the reason for doing this, is that breaking records or setting records, doing them with endurance-related flying, sends out terrifically positive messages about what you can do with diabetes when so many aviation authorities around the world prevent us from flying. You can fly. You can fly safely and effectively, and it's just a delight and a pleasure to be able to do trips like these.
Cairns is now joined on many of his excursions, including the one to the North Pole this week, by another British pilot with type 1 diabetes, 22-year-old Carl Beetson. He helps Cairns with communications and his website while planning and executing these trips. He says he and Cairns share similar experiences.
My aspirations were crushed. I wanted to be an airline pilot, and once I got diagnosed, I just found out, it's never going to happen. So it was quite defeating at the time, and I had to overcome that, or else I would have just had poor control, and it would have made my health really bad. And being focused on something like flying is enabling me to keep good control, and I'm helping others that want to be able to do stuff that may find that they face restrictions.
Also with Cairns on the trip was veteran pilot Ron Sheardown of Anchorage, who has several North Pole expeditions under his belt. He was there to provide backup in a support Cessna 185 in case there was any trouble. Cairns says he hopes to come back to Barrow to attempt another polar flight, where he lands his light twin-engine aircraft on the sea ice right at the North Pole. In Barrow, I'm Jake Neer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The advance of spring is winding down the heating season, but state and local officials want Fairbanks area residents who burn wood to start preparing for next year. The public outreach Split, Stack, Store, and Save campaign is aimed at reducing fine particulate pollution. North Star Borough PM2.5 project coordinator Christy DeHaven says prepping wood early will ensure it's ready for efficient burning by next fall.
By preparing their stack now, they will allow the wood to have enough time to dry before burning it next winter. And one of the things that we're trying to remind people is that when you burn dry wood, you are getting more heat out of the wood, so you're having to burn less wood, and so that's where it saves you money. And also, it'll actually have fewer emissions.
DeHaven says dry wood also produces less creosote on stovepipe, reducing the chance of a chimney fire. Burning green wood is a major source of local fine particulate pollution that's landed Fairbanks in violation of federal clean air standards. The state and borough are charged with coming up with ways to clean up local air. DeHaven says following some simple steps will result in dry wood.
Regardless of whether you have it delivered or whether you're doing it yourself, you want to make sure that you are cutting the wood into lengths of 2 feet or less. You want to split the wood in half at least once, depending on how thick the log is. You then want to take that and stack all your wood into a pile in a covered woodshed or cover it with a tarp. You want to make sure that you're able to keep any rain or snow off the top of the stack and keep it from going down into the stack. But you also want to allow for proper airflow through the stack on the sides.
DeHaven says depending on the wood, the weather, and the amount of sunlight your woodpile gets, logs can be dry enough to burn cleanly and efficiently in 6 months. The National Indian Child Welfare Association is wrapping up its 29th and largest annual conference in Anchorage. About 900 people from across the United States and Canada attended. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
The National Indian Child Welfare Act Association, or NICWA, cites a 1976 study that said 25 to 35% of all American Indian and Alaska Native children were being placed in out-of-home care. The Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978, or ICWA, was adopted to help keep Native children with their families, extended families, and tribes. Anishinaabe tribal member Howard Copenace works in children's services and serves on a First Nations council in Ontario, Canada. He says removal from their home and traditional culture leaves many children without a sense of identity.
Some of them do fit in, come back and, you know, regain it, but some, you know, they just stay for a little bit and, you know, they're so lost and confused, they just leave the community again.
ICWA has been in place for decades now, but Alaska is among the top five states that still disproportionately remove Native children from their homes. Dennis Swain is the statewide ICWA director for the Alaska Office of Children's Services.
Everyone's real clear that the disproportionality roughly in our state is that over 60% of the children in custody are Native children, though our population by census shows anywhere from 15 to 18%, depending on the source. So we're real clear that Native children come into custody at a lot more alarming rate than any other child. And we had hoped that the Indian Child Welfare Act, when created, would have changed those numbers.
Swain says the state has already and will continue to expand communications and share decision-making with tribes. Christy Alberti, a Cherokee and NICWA Executive Communications Manager, says the state, the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes, other tribes, and NICWA are collaborating on a research and analysis project. She says the Western and Pacific Implementation Center is looking at ways families could rely on home-based services to keep children out of custody in the first place.
But it also looks at the fact that foster care is a very expensive option. And so whenever you can try and keep services in the home, you can try and promote a preventative model rather than that intervention type model. It seems to be a win-win situation for the state and for tribes, and ultimately for the children.
On the national front, NICWA Legislative Affairs Advocacy Director David Simmons says NICWA is working to implement the Fostering Connections Act of 2008.
It was a federal law that was passed in October of 2008 that gave American Indian Alaska Native tribes for the very first time access to be able to operate their own Title 4E programs from the Social Security Act. It's the federal government's largest child welfare entitlement program that funds services related to the placement of children in out-of-home placements like foster care, guardianships, adoption, relative care, things like that. And it's a big, big deal.
The conference included 70-some workshops and panel discussions on these and a wide range of other topics. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Southeast Alaska's largest tribal organization continues to push for more federal involvement in subsistence. The Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska made it a priority at this month's annual meeting. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The past few years have seen battles over traditional hunting and fishing in Southeast and other parts of the state. That led the Central Council and some other Native organizations to renew their focus on subsistence. Many of the concerns pertain to state enforcement actions on federal land. Council President Ed Thomas says delegates at this month's General Assembly meeting passed a resolution making it clear that subsistence remains a priority.
The federal government says that it's stepping in to take over management on federal lands, but they don't include that in their budgeting. The agencies primarily have other priorities that they put in their budgeting process. So subsistence, through the absence of a federal presence, ends up back in the state jurisdiction anyway.
Reapportionment was another concern and the topic of another resolution. Plans for Southeast House and Senate districts released by a state board would make it difficult for either of the region's rural native legislators to win re-election.
I know that you can't isolate rural communities when you get into redistricting, but very often the voice of our rural people get consumed by the larger numbers in urban centers.
Other resolutions addressed foster care, transportation, legal protections for Native art, and health issues. The 76th Annual Tribal Assembly also heard about reductions in funding for programs it runs. Thomas says that's been expected and has been reflected in Central Council spending.
We're in a budget-cutting mood. We want to prepare ourselves in the event there are further federal cuts and state cuts. So administratively, we're tightening our belt.
He says the total yearly budget is about $30 million, varying as grants come and go. Thomas says that includes about $7 million in administration costs, which was reduced close to 10% this year. The council provides a variety of services to members, including housing, health, elder support, employment, and training. About 120 delegates attended the General Assembly, held at Juneau's Alaska Native Brotherhood Hall. They represent more than 27,000 tribal members in Southeast Alaska and elsewhere. Next year's Tribal Assembly will also be held in the capital city. It will include elections for president and other officers. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Jacob Resnick in Kodiak, Jake Neer in Barrow, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
No other port in Alaska is building a 100-rail car loop like the one going in at Port McKenzie. Exporting natural resources from rail to ship will be more efficient than ever. A single limestone deposit in the interior could mean a cement industry in Alaska. Port McKenzie Rail, hundreds of millions in state revenues, thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.